everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games. I'm your co-host, sick in both body and mind, Mark Bigney, and with me as always is my co-host, Michael Walker, pure, smooth, unctuous, and satisfying like mama's apple pie. How are you doing, Walker?
That's me. I'm doing great. I'm super excited. We're off from a full weekend of gaming.
Actually, that's why I've got the sort of bug in my throat. I've got a little bit of the con plague, I think. A full weekend of yelling at people to explain games and then yelling at them for not having paid attention to the game explanation and then yelling at them for playing wrong is it's worn me out, and so now I hardly have the energy to yell at you anymore. So,
but that being said, we got to introduce people to all sorts of new and interesting games. I even had someone ask me to show them an interesting and exciting deck builder. So I went and grabbed Eon's End, and I used it as a step stool to get my Mystic Veil off the top shelf. So that was great.
I'm not cut out to be a troll walker, especially when the Eon's End folks are so much more... They clearly have more endurance than I do for the topic. You're killing me here.
It's all good.
All right. So we're going to mix things up this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. We're going to talk about our feature game, which is Too Many Bones, specifically the new Undertow expansion. And then our topic this week is going to be difficulty in co-ops. How hard should co-ops be? So with that in mind, let us just jump right into the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Well, we got Ethnos out again. I think we should talk more about Ethnos because I think it's just a fantastic game. The pacing is amazing. The flow is there. It's play or draw, Mark. Play or draw.
It's true. Being able to chant that as people when and if people take too long is great. I noticed there are two very strange verbal tics that I introduced that seem to have caught hold locally. One is saying orc board over and over and over again with respect to anything that has even remote verbal similarity to orc board. The other is when you pull a dragon, saying dragon in the highest falsetto you can possibly imagine before proceeding to the next step.
Ethnos is a fantastic game with huge variability. All these different races that you form this deck with, and each race has its own ability, and you're playing down either sets of colors or sets of races to get area control on this map, and it's just a great, quick little game by Simon. Ethnos.
Got to play El Grande. This was actually at the start of the event that we were at this weekend. A bunch of people were milling around wondering what to play, and I said, you know what? I am surrounded by a whole bunch of people who call themselves gamers, and none of these people have played El Grande, and that is a shame. So we played vanilla El Grande without any of the expansions, although some of the expansions I do enjoy. El Grande is in many ways still, I think, the best area majority game that there is. You know, when playing a coin game or a lot of the more complicated games, I often wish I were playing El Grande instead. And this was a great game, came right down to the wire. The winning score was one higher than the second place score, and this was in a game where multiple people scored in excess of 100 points. It was tense, it was fluid. In other words, it was a game of El Grande. I have yet to play a game of El Grande that stagnated or lacked tension as the game went on. It's aged so very, very well. Much like my fine co-host. And so I cannot recommend El Grande enough. I haven't played the new Z-Man big box version, but at least I've seen pictures, and at least one thing is true of that version over the version that I have, which is that they don't have misprints on the board. It's obnoxious. They misprinted the names of the provinces on the board. They got rid of some of the double L's, and which is a huge pronunciation deal for when you're pronouncing the names of the Spanish regions, but not that it really matters. It is very, very abstract. It was originally themed around the Trojan War, after all. But El Grande is a marvelous game, and if you call yourself a gamer and you haven't played it yet, then I think that there's something serious. It's a serious lacuna in your experience, and I recommend you give it a shot, whether or not you like area majority games, because it might change your mind. And so that's El Grande, a perennial favorite of many a gamer.
You and I got to play a new game called Who Goes There. It's a fantastic produced game.
Yes.
I've never seen anything like it since Mechs and Minions.
It's very pretty.
Everything fits perfectly in. It's got these fantastic inserts.
The multi-level character boards that hold everything nice and tight until you pay the experience to unlock them, and then they go up to the main board. The art style is very, very good. It's sort of a vaguely evocative of a French comic book style, and the miniatures are extremely... Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful game.
This would all be fantastic, except for the fact that you actually have to play the game.
Yeah, that is a bit of a downside. I mean, that is probably one of the weaker elements of the game, you know, the game itself.
All right, that being said, Now, I was thinking about it. Neither you or I like Dead of Winter.
No.
Nor do we like Police Precinct. I don't know even if you've played Police Precinct.
I haven't.
But I'm going to throw all of these games into a genre I'm going to call deck milling games. And I just don't like deck milling games. And I really think that Who Goes There has more issues than that. But that is definitely one of them. It is a game based on...
It's a game based on the novella Who Goes There, which inspired the movie The Thing.
There you go.
So in many ways...
I'm searching for the director's name of The Thing, but yes.
John Carpenter. So this is more The Thing than The Thing. This is the hipster The Thing. This is The Thing before it was cool.
And when I read things about it, I thought it was fantastic. You pass this clicker back and forth, you know, determining to see if, you know, the person you're bunking with is The Thing or the person you just traded to is The Thing and now you're a thing. And then you have to do this crazy math equation, you know, times pi times the elevation of the helicopter and how many times the propeller's gone around. And if you beat that number, then you get to fly two steps in the air.
Walker, with so many flaws of the game, you don't need to embellish ones. The final calculation is merely times six. That's not a massive math problem.
It's true.
It's a little abstract to keep having to remind people what times six it is, making the final determination. Anyway, to a certain extent, I think we're burying the lead. I think you're exactly right. It is fundamentally a deck milling game. In order to accumulate victory points, you just need to go and do this risky thing and over, which is drawing from these decks. And very often you're going to get nothing for it, and drawing a card will constitute at least a third or more of your turn. I think we need to spend at least a couple minutes. No.
Bury this even more? Sure.
Well, no. Here was my biggest concern when reading the rulebook. When reading the rulebook, I was concerned about two factors. One factor was it seemed like the kind of game where individuals wouldn't do much on their turn, but the game would last very long, 2 to 3 hours. And that was very much borne out. The other thing that I was very concerned about was once you are infected, once you're a member of the aliens, once you become a traitor, your victory conditions do not change. They become the exact same as they were before. You get points the same way, you accumulate them the same way, and you score the same way. It's just now your score is added to a different tally. And my immediate reaction to that was, so where's the substance to the paranoia? What action is the suspect individual going to perform to cause people to become suspicious of this individual? How do they have to hide? And the answer is they don't. There's no change to the gameplay. You're involved in a tedious deck milling exercise, unless and until you might become infected, and then you continue the tedious deck milling exercise. It's just now you're on the other team. And you clearly don't have the stomach for going on for the next 10 minutes about many of the other awful things that the thing that Who Goes There does. But that was one of the biggest concerns for me. And for what it is worth, I agree with you that it belongs in a lot of those deck milling games, but it also to me belongs in the same category as games like Battlestar Galactica, which tries to involve paranoia and intrigue, but just has a overcumbered system that goes on too long and is just tedious bookkeeping until such time as something weird happens anyway.
That's right. Yeah, it has this great crafting system where you get to build your weapons and stuff, but they made it so difficult to do that it doesn't make it interesting and fun. It just makes it even more tedious and painful.
I agree.
And that is Who Goes There.
I got in some of the expansions from Street Masters that I didn't have access to before. When we did our initial review, we had access to the original Kickstarter Base Pledge, which had tons and tons and tons of content, and Blacklist Games, which is the company founded by the Sadler brothers, has made the subsequent material available on their web store, namely the Twin Tiger expansion as well as the Redemption expansion, so I picked those up. And so I've been playing a number of games with the new stuff, and I have to say that the sheer amount of content available is very, very, very good. And every time I've been playing, I've just been reminded of some of my reflections when we initially reviewed it was, in many ways, I wish this is what Sentinel Tactics had been, because it's very similar to Sentinels of the Multiverse in terms of structure, in terms of how the decks work and so on, but it has this lovely little low-maintenance spatial aspect to really give some teeth. And it actually... It's so low maintenance, actually, that it makes it easier to play because you don't have to worry about who is the target with the lowest hit points or the highest hit points or whatever. No, instead you get to consider things like adjacency and proximity, which are easier to eyeball in many instances. But the problem is that the theme of Street Masters is much less compelling than the incredibly compelling universe of Sentinels of the Multiverse. So I wish, in an ideal universe, Street Masters would be the Sentinel Tactics game. But I have been enjoying the new content. Playing new fighters is always great. I was a bit disappointed that the Kickstarter exclusive expansion, Legend of Oni, didn't have any new characters, because new characters are always what I gravitate towards and stuff like this. So anyway, I've been continuing to enjoy Street Masters, and the new stuff is great. I can't thoroughly recommend that you go pick it up from the web store, because they've been having serious fulfillment issues. You know, orders have been seriously delayed. I'm still waiting on replacement stuff that I asked for back in June, and I still haven't received any replacement stuff. Anyhow, they've been having some growing pains as a company. But I've been enjoying some more Street Masters, specifically Twin Tiger.
Nice. I got to introduce Mark to Level 7 by Privateer Press.
Well, Level 7 Invasion. There are three Level 7 games now.
Level 7 Invasion. It's a dudes on a map co-op game that I don't think has been replicated anywhere that I know of. And a fantastic game where you got to lead this, you know, alien scientist across the world while he works on this virus to drive back the alien invaders. And as you kill the alien invaders, they adapt and get new abilities to, you know, push you back. And I think overall, I think everyone enjoyed it, even though there were some reservations about it. But I think overall, everyone had a good time.
I enjoyed it a great deal. I don't know that I'd play it again. It was a little too procedural and a little too easy for my tastes. Again, more on that later on in our topic. And so, you know, it's got a 15-step turn structure. And so in a way, I'm surprised you enjoy it as much as you do, because you've been opening my eyes to the importance of good flow. And Level 7 Invasion has no flow. It has anti-flow. It has, you know, several points of the game things screech to a halt because you have to remind people, no, that happens two steps from now. Now we're doing this thing, and this leads to this other thing, and so forth. I wish it were a little bit harder. I wish it led to a little bit more genuine cooperation. It seemed to kind of give you blinkers just to focus on your own continent. There were a number of ways that the game prevented you limiting the trades, cards only affecting your own area, and so assistance was a little bit strange. It also has a personal bugbear of mine, fixed number of factions regardless of the number of players. So there's always going to be five factions in play, so that's awkward. Five especially is really awkward for player count. That's basically five or one is the only way to make sure that everyone plays the same number of factions, which is a strange preference of mine, but nonetheless, it's one that I have. But you're absolutely right. The adaptation system, the research system is very, very, very cool and is very fun to deal with. I still prefer Level 7 Omega Protocol. They're radically different games, of course. There have been three games in the system, as I said. There's Level 7 Escape, which was kind of dreck. There was Omega Protocol, which I think is the best 1v-all tactical game. And then there's Level 7 Invasion. And Will Scuvener from Privateer has had his hands in all of them, and they're very, very, very different games. But I think it looks like they're not doing anything else with the sort of series that they've done, because the last thing they did was Invasion, and that was 4 or 5 years ago, so... But yeah, I enjoyed Level 7 Invasion. Thank you for showing it to me. Don't know that I'll be clamoring to play it again.
No, it's definitely, like I said, I think it's like a once a year type event game for sure.
Sure. We also got to try Grand Austria Hotel. This is something that I've been wanting to try because it is a kind of a Euro game with a vaguely dice action selection thing. And it was co-designed by Simone Luciani, who co-designed The Voyages of Marco Polo, which, as you well know, we are both big fans of, and also involves a Euro dice selection mechanic thing. It was all right. It was, again, a little too procedural. I found, actually, that the dice were kind of detracted from the overall game, because very frequently you would desperately need something in order to progress in just running your hotel, which is a charming enough theme, but the dice just didn't give it to you because there are these hard caps on acquiring certain things, specifically cake and coffee. Yes. And if the dice say that you don't get any cake or coffee, you don't get any cake or coffee. And that's kind of a bit unfortunate. It wasn't even like in Voyages of Marco Polo, where you could just spend scarce resources to make the dice fit what you wanted. You were pretty much boned in many instances. And that, and the fact that the downtime was pretty bad, especially given how it works on a serpentine turn order. Everyone has two actions, but it's in a folding turn order. And that just made it feel really more cumbersome than the game was. If you're first or second in turn order, you can spend a long time between turns. Anyway, I thought it was fine, but it was just a relatively pedestrian Euro optimization thing. It was at least better than a lot of the, you know, point salad games, because you did feel genuine constraints on things like money. The money constraint I thought was great, because you always felt poor. And that kind of harshness I appreciate. But when the game system itself is just saying, yeah, there's no coffee or cake to be had, good luck. That's not really the kind of constraint I enjoy. So if things had been a little bit looser there, or if there had been a little bit more slack in some of the areas, again, like Voyages of Marco Polo, I probably would have enjoyed it more. So that was Grand Austria Hotel. What did you think of it?
I liked it. I think I wish the theme was a little more prevalent, but it seemed all right. You open up rooms, people come in. It's like a typical, you know, fulfill order type of game. But like you said, it was painful when the last of all the characters all needed a certain commodity and there was just no way we could get it, and it just bogged the game down that much more. The fact that even the turn order and the fact that you couldn't do anything, it just slogged out the last few turns, seemed a little painful. And that was Grand Austria Hotel.
Final game I'd like to talk about is Mechanus Burgo. Mechanus Burgo is a game that probably by all rights I should hate. It's sloppy, it's messy, it's very much too long, even for what it is. The iconography is inconsistent and a bit of a mess, so you constantly have to look up in the rulebook to see what a given thing does. But you have to concede that any game that lets you deploy a cyber velociraptor against the space church so as to win the rights to hold a motor combat, it's getting something right.
It's so true.
And
this is when you have to decide whether you want to do that or, you know, the psychedelic rave or the, you know, the five other crazy things that you can do.
And look, in the game that we played, my characters, who consisted of a couple of celebrities, managed to dominate the social scene. And at the same time, Walker was off in the corner building a small coterie of incredibly violent thugs and combat robots. And then, near the end of the game, he said, ah, screw it, I don't want to rule the city, I'll just take it over. And he declared himself to be the enemy of everyone, and we, the other players, couldn't get our act together to stop him, mainly because we committed some crucial mistakes. Anyway, all of this is to say, Mechanus Burgo is basically a worker placement game, but there's a lot of other stuff going on. It's got assassinations and hacking and sabotage and all this other stuff. I have a soft spot for Mechanus Burgo that is probably in excess of its actual merits. But it does do things that I haven't seen other games do very well, or even at all. And it's got this lovely sort of cyberpunk 1950s or 60s era sci-fi feel, all with the lovely veneer of the Spanish language put on top of it. So I didn't deliberately set out to play two games with a lot of Spanish in it over the weekend, but that is what ended up happening. And Mechanus Burgo also has, there's never a dull moment in it, at least, in terms of seeing what the new turn has to offer you. There may be a bit of a dull moment if someone says, wait, how does assassination work again? And you have to remind them because there's a lot of rules to keep track of. But unlike a lot of other games that are, you know, 3 to 4 hour worker placement affairs, at least Mechanus Burgo has character and it's got a lot of novelty to it and a lot of interesting stuff happens. So that's my sort of tentative pitch for Mechanus Burgo. I still enjoy it.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I didn't feel like I won, but whatever. It was,
dude,
sort of like
you earned that, dude.
It was
you kicked our asses good.
Since you pray, I'm just gonna, I think the resolution took a little while, like once you've placed everything, like I love that part, how you place your workers out, how you know, incorporate all your minions and your provinces. But then once you start the resolution, that seems to really bog down a lot. And then some of the actions have a huge swing, right?
Yes.
Because you get to play, you have an action hand of cards that are 1 through 6. And then some of the abilities where you can draw a card off the top of the deck, which is a 0 through 8.
Yes.
So that could be a huge swing. But other than that, it is very, very interesting and fun little game.
The thing you have to internalize with Mechanus Burgo, and it's actually less, in many ways it's less random than it seems, because yes, the consequence of any individual action may have a huge swing. But the thing is, you have to accept that your corporation is going to undergo some churn. Because it looks like a worker placement game, like a lot of other worker placement games, where you go out and you get new workers. And almost any worker placement game where you can do that, that's the dominant strategy. But in Mechanus Burgo, you have to accept the fact that you're going to undergo some churn. I was actually in a bit of a problem because nobody had assassinated or seduced away or in any other ways incapacitated any of my characters. And as a result, I had nothing to do in the third round. It was actually constraining because there was no point in my going and getting new employees. So you have to accept that you're always going to be fluctuating. It's a bit like Civilization in that regard. I can't believe I'm comparing Mechanus Burgo and Civilization. There's such... But it's a bit like Civilization, the fact that you have to accept the fact that you're going to lose some cities, but they're going to come back. You have to accept that there's a bit of an ebb and flow to these things, and Mechanus Burgo is the same way. I think I need to retire now in shame from having made that analogy, but I'll stand by it. So those are the games we played last week. Now let's move on to the news and why it doesn't matter. What do you have for the news here, Walker?
I have one news item, and for some reason I feel we already talked about it, but I'm going to talk about it again because I just saw it. And that's an expansion for Feast for Odin called The Norwegians.
It's true. We didn't talk about it. I talked about it, but you don't listen to what I say. So
that's what fine. I'm saying. That's what I assumed, but I just tune out anything you say anyway.
So. Sure.
So now you have horses and pigs and all sorts of interesting things you get to add. And a whole new board, whole new buildings. And the amount of people that played Feast for Odin over the weekend and played Great Western Trail, and they all love those games, so I'm looking forward to even more crazy Euro action in the future.
I've got a couple things in terms of upcoming products, and then I'd actually like to move on to news that does matter. So the news that doesn't matter is BattleCon, which is one of my favorite two-player games. It was the first game I ever kickstarted. They're now coming up with their own one box to hold them all. They're going to be launching this Kickstarter on Friday this week. So I fully anticipate that the box production will become a waking nightmare, and we will see it only in 2 to 3 years, much like Oblivion did. The other new product coming up is an expansion for the quest for El Dorado called Heroes and Hexes. And like any deck builder, you obviously want more stuff. This actually isn't going to be adding many new cards, but it's going to be introducing some faction asymmetry from the start and a whole bunch of other stuff. Anyway, I've said before, I think Reiner Knizia is back. He's designing games that I like again, and so I'm very much looking forward to his new output. That's going to be coming out in Essen this year. Now I'd like to move on to news that I think does actually matter. I want to talk about a game called Manitoba. Have you heard about this, Walker?
I have heard a little bit about it.
Okay, here's the deal. So DLP Games, which is the publishing house set up and operated by Rainer Stockhausen, who's the guy who brought us Orléans and Altiplano, among other things, is publishing a game called Manitoba. Here's the problem. Let me stress right from the outset that when it comes to claims of cultural appropriation per se, I'm not moved by such claims in and of itself. I don't have any necessary problems with it. Here's the thing. In Manitoba, you're nominally representing different groups of Cree. And in this game, you progress along a totem pole path. Like there's this integrated mechanics about building totem poles. The Cree don't build totem poles. They never have. And in all likelihood, they never will. And here's why this is galling. All right. It's galling because totem poles possess deep cultural and religious and spiritual significance for the people that do construct totem poles. And the fact that the publisher is obviously so indifferent to even finding out the first facts about totem poles. We're not talking about deep research here. We're not even talking about a trip to the library. We're not even talking about, oh goodness, cracking open a book. We're talking like the first two paragraphs of Wikipedia here, right? The fact that a publisher, anywhere, from any country, would seek to use a religious or spiritually significant artifact and practice as dressing in a game, and they can't even be bothered to read the first couple paragraphs from Wikipedia about a given practice, that, I think, indicates a level of intellectual laziness that I find in the abstract unsustainable. And in the particular, I think it shows a certain degree of contempt. And that contempt, I think, is what is bothersome. I'm going to try to retire the word offensive because it's often misused, and I don't really care about feelings. I don't care if anyone's offended. I don't care that I'm offended or whether any Cree people are offended or any Haida people are offended. That's not the point. The point isn't about feelings. The point is about contempt for cultures not your own, and that I don't think is acceptable, whether it's in a commercial context or in any other context. And let's be clear here. Because a lot of whataboutism showed up in a massive 14-page thread on BoardGameGeek about this. And a lot of whataboutism showed up even when the CBC, our national state media, ran a news piece about this and contacted Rainer Stockhausen in interviews. So there's a lot of whataboutism. It's like, well, you know games about the mafia. Well, you know games about my country. Well, you know the movie Gladiator. I don't care. First of all, some of those may be acceptable, some of them may not be acceptable. But we are not talking about Viking helmets having horns on them or something. And I personally don't care, and I don't think it's problematic or contemptible if you display the Cree using canoes that they didn't traditionally use. Obviously, there's a line, right? And I think that shape of tint or type of coloring or anything like that is on one side of the line, and I think that using someone's religious practices as window dressing when you obviously don't care, that's on the other side of the line. That is the standard that I am articulating here. And it's clear, just for context, that the contempt and indifference that the publisher had for the theming here went far beyond that when on the back of the box they talk about Manitoba's, and I quote, majestic mountains, end quote, which further shows that, see, I finally got Walker on my side. The rest of the time he was looking very skeptical, but now I think he finally understands where I'm coming from. Anybody who knows anything about Manitoba at all, and it's the name of the game, knows that there are no mountains in Manitoba. The highest elevation and the lowest elevation are separated by roughly the length of my forefinger. And some of you might be saying, oh, but Eurogames don't care. Then, if Eurogames don't care, I would say two things. Number one, don't start messing with people's cultural traditions. Make it about something else. If it doesn't matter, then don't start messing with other cultures' traditions. And I could start talking about colonialism, but I don't have to. I think you don't even have to start bringing in things like cultural appropriation or colonialism to talk about how this is a problematic practice. I don't think you have to. The second thing I would say to the claim about, oh, it's a Eurogame, things don't care, I would point to the works of Cole Wuerl, of Martin Wallace, of Uwe Rosenberg, some of the works of Rainer Knizia, Matt Gertz. These are Euro designers who design Eurogames very often, and they do copious research, and their games are better for it. They feel more grounded, the thematic consistency is often greater, they often come with lovely little unnecessary but beautiful value-added almanacs talking about the historical context of what's going on. These are people who take their work seriously, and that's what I'm talking about here. It is professionally contemptuous to put out a product like this, and I think that they deserve to be ashamed of that, if nothing else. So that's what I have to say about Manitoba as a board game critic, not necessarily a cultural critic or an ethnic studies critic. And I really do think that all the whataboutism and all the it doesn't matter is really missing the point. And I think you're really burying the lead if you start talking about, like, oh, well, you know, the Vikings with the horned helmets. Not the same, not analogous.
How about Pillars of the Earth? Isn't that the one where they use a cathedral? You build a cathedral as a timing mechanism?
Sure. But the culture in question built cathedrals. If Pillars of the Earth had you building a mosque medieval England or in medieval central France, the analogy, one of the analogies that was raised in Board Game Geek, I thought was quite good. It's like, this would be like the Bavarians building Stonehenge.
Yeah, right. That's the one I was going to bring up too. I thought that was hilarious.
Like, even setting aside the fact that Stonehenge represents a religious tradition that is mostly dead, when we're talking about active religious and spiritual traditions that are currently being practiced, I don't think you have to be practicing a certain spiritual or religious tradition to recognize that you should, if you are going to deal with it in your work of fiction or in your commercial product, do your due diligence. And we can all have reasonable disagreements about what due diligence constitutes. I'm going to establish that a minimum baseline for decency is read the Wikipedia entry. That is the minimum standard of decency that I'm going to articulate.
That works for Simon, apparently, when they, you know...
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. We made fun of them when they pulled the Kotahi mess, right?
Yeah.
And I think that they deserve to be ashamed for their sloppy level of research for that product. And that was a marginal Kickstarter exclusive one monster in a pantheon of things they were just clearly adding later on. This is the core conceit of the game. It's not even just the trappings of the cover art, which apparently the cover art, you know, commits like a billion other fundamental cultural mistakes. But we're talking about the core conceit of the game, about a religious tradition that does not apply to the people in question. And this is also for broader reference, and I think you should do some reading on this. This is broader. This is part of a broader tradition of a strange fascination on the part of some people from Germany about First Nations people in Canada, the United States, which has a whole bunch of other problematic stuff. But honestly, as a board gamer, I'm seriously, if nothing else, set aside my feelings as a human being or whatever other political views I have. As a board gamer, I am ashamed that a man like Rainer Stockhausen, who has a legitimate profile in our hobby, can get away with crap like this, or thinks he can get away with crap like this, and this level of carelessness and sloppiness and intellectual laziness. And that's the minimum of what I think one can say in this particular case. Do you think I've overstepped, Walker?
Not at all.
All right, then. I've said my piece. I think it's an important issue that deserves more serious discussion, but I think that this is not the venue for the more serious discussion, and I don't think Walker would have the stomach for the more serious discussion anyway. So we're going to stick to what we can agree on, and that's what we're going to agree on. So that's what I have to say about Manitoba. On to our feature game. Our feature game this week is Too Many Bones, specifically Too Many Bones Undertow, which is the newest standalone expansion in the Too Many Bones product line, which is now which now consists of two base games and a relatively decent number of possible add-ons. Just for a little bit of context, this was put out by Adam Carlson and Josh Carlson of Chip Theory Games. The base game, the first base game of Too Many Bones, was released last year. It was, in fact, on my top 10 of 2017. And they got their start as a company by publishing Hoplomachus, which is a very, very light dice-chucking gladiatorial combat thing. And the company is known for their peculiar approach to components. And I say peculiar both in a good and a bad way. They firmly believe that they want to use heavyweight, professional-grade poker chips as their in place of counters. They like using custom dice and lots of it, although to varying degrees. And they also don't believe in boards. They believe in neoprene mats. And basically, one gets the impression that in an ideal world, they would put out all products that contain no cardboard aside from the box. And to a certain extent, they've succeeded. Because in the case of Too Many Bones, all the cards, of which there are many, are made out of PVC. The entire game is waterproof. And indeed, they have videos of them playing it underwater. And that's the sort of context for the product lines that they put out. Most recently, what they put out after Too Many Bones Undertow was a game called Triplock, which is a very, very simple solo or competitive puzzle memory type game. Didn't really appeal to me, so I haven't tried it. And they're going to be coming out with new stuff in the future, and so that's the sort of broader company context of what Chip Theory Games has been doing. Why don't you, Walker, give your traditional patented description of what one does in Too Many Bones?
Well, in Too Many Bones, it's the traditional sort of dungeon delving, little gear locks on a quest, cool little gnomish type goblin type halfling type creatures. And there's about seven different types you can choose from. And in the usual dungeon delving way, much like Descent and Imperial Assault, every single character has a path that you can go down that changes the character up in different ways. And most of the gear locks in Too Many Bones have three different paths. And it's usually not a fantastic idea to, you know, diversify in all of them. It's usually the best way is to, you know, emphasize one and check it out, or, you know, think on what the boss is and do what's best that way. So deciding which path to go down, figuring out the best way to gain and spend those sweet, sweet training points that's going to get you more dice, and figure out really how your gear lock works and have fun playing.
So it's another entry in the thankfully very crowded co-op fantasy tactical combat game. Basically, the market, and we've commented on this before, the market has been moving away from things like Talisman, like Prophecy, like other wandering around overland games where combat is resolved with D6, and say, well, why don't we reduce the wandering to something very, very, very simple and abstracted and make the combat a little bit more fleshed out? And for someone who's fundamentally still a tabletop minis gamer at heart in many ways, this is very much the approach that I like, especially because the overland travel of a lot of adventure games like that is not particularly engaging or compelling. Overland travel can be done well, like The Quest for El Dorado. I like that game. But it's not trying to be this kind of game. So let's talk about that asymmetry that you were talking about. There are 10 characters available now, 4 in the base game of Too Many Bones, 2 more in Undertow, and then the remaining 4 are add-ons that you can buy separately. And honestly, of all the add-ons, the characters, very much as I've said before, are the things that I recommend the most. The asymmetry here is so huge that it actually reminds me teaching a bit like Root, in that you start with the core game elements, and there's more in common amongst across the different gear locks than there is in something like Root, but then you have to spend a little bit of time explaining to each player how their character works. Now, this goes all the way from a simpler character like Pickett, who doesn't really have much by way of weirdness, most of it is reasonably straightforward, all the way to something like Tink, which I've had to explain to many people because Tink builds and runs robots, and everyone wants to do that because that's obviously awesome. But everything is very, very, very in-depth and kind of unique to his character. This costs Dex. This doesn't cost Dex. This is when this happens. This gets deployed. This thing, this die works this way, but this die works this other way because it's rainy on a Tuesday, etc., etc. And this is, you know, honestly, like every other game of this type, both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength because you get these radically different experiences playing these different characters, but it can get a little bit tedious explaining to somebody if they don't know the game backwards and forwards. If somebody already knows the core rules and is able to internalize what's on the back of the sheet, then all's well and good for the most part, even though the rules sometimes aren't particularly clearly worded. But as somebody who really likes strongly asymmetric experiences, I do think that that is one of the best elements of Too Many Bones.
Yeah, I have the exact same sentence on here, much like Root and or Vast, that every character plays their own sort of game. The way that they've incorporated these dice to work in such different ways is really fun to watch. and interesting. Everyone, you know, I mean, everyone is fun. It's not as though, you know, in Vast where, you know, the cave was completely boring and whatever, but every single character is fun to play.
It also helps that it's co-op, right? Because then you naturally have to find ways to interact with the other player to compensate for their weaknesses and be able to do things that they can't do.
And each character comes with this huge, like you said, this huge sheet that you can follow along and look ahead and shows you all the dice facing so you can sort of, you know, hopefully figure out what to do.
Yeah, it's a bit daunting because you see all these custom dice, you see this wall of text explaining how the character works uniquely, and one of the ways in which Too Many Bones, I think, makes things more complicated than it needs to be, or at least more daunting than it needs to be, is that sometimes a skill only makes sense when you pay attention to a single letter next to the skill description. The difference between a skill being an active skill versus a locked skill, an instant skill versus a counter skill, these minor differences that are so easy to gloss over, even for an experienced player, that might make all the difference and turn a die from borderline useless into amazing. And some of the information presentation is not as good as it could be. It's been getting better. I remember back in the first printing of the base game of Too Many Bones, the reference sheets didn't even include the die faces on them. They just had a vague thematic description of what it was. So then what you had to do was you had to get this reference sheet, pick out the die from your tray, look at all the faces, look at an icon on the die, and then cross-reference it back to the sheet to figure out what that icon did. It was a pain. But say what you want about Chip Theory Games, and I will very shortly. So don't worry. Fans of Chip Theory Games, you can sharpen your pitchforks for now because I'm defending them here now. They've been extremely good at making sure that every owner of the game can get the newest stuff with a minimum of expense and hassle. They've been incredibly heroic in that regard, and I give them full credit for that.
So I just want to talk quickly about how the actual game works. It's, if you've played Gloomhaven, then you sort of know how it sort of works. These are like the city cards. You're, instead of having like this long, grueling map that you have to move across, you set up this campaign deck where you just flip through the deck, and when you get to the bottom, that's the boss. And every time you flip up a card, it gives you a little scenario, and you have two options, and they're going to give you different rewards or whatever it is. And that leads to another point I was going to make later, is the fact that you can either do a short game or a long game, because a lot of the options on these cards are just to run away or to exit or just to do one that doesn't cause a battle. So if you don't feel like doing a super long game, you can sort of streamline your way and get to the end, or you can fight out each battle. And then once you've decided to do the battle, then you just take out this little neoprene mat, you set up your guys, and it's this little, you know, skirmish-type game, and it's very interesting and fun.
So the deck of encounters, I think, has really been growing by leaps and bounds. The variety in the core game was impressive in terms of the kind of encounters they do. Sometimes you get surprised with these charming little mini-games. There was actually, I don't want to spoil too much, but without going into too much detail, there's a dexterity challenge in some of the encounter cards of the base game. And I love weird little nonsense like that, especially in a co-op game where you don't have to worry about balance too much. Ways to modify the fight. Some of the modifications are simple. Some of them are a little bit more in-depth. Some of them change the way you approach how your character operates. Some of them are a little unfair. Some of them might completely kneecap one character while not affecting another character. But again, you're there for the variety. To a certain extent, you're there for the ride. And the fact that the balance isn't perfectly fine-tuned is kind of okay when you are presented with interesting scenarios. And with the expansion in Undertow, I really feel like they've dialed that up to 11. I was actually going to complain about the sense of humor in the game, in that it's often a bunch of kind of cheesy puns. But I have to say, they've upped their pun game in Undertow, I think, to a certain extent. I was immediately charmed when in the first game of Undertow I played, there was a Clash reference, and it was about whether on the raft, should I stay or should I row? And then, after that, immediately, and I was like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of cute. And then immediately thereafter, I drew a loot card that made reference to Guns N' Roses. And at that point, I was, okay, fine. You've won me over. I was originally not totally sold on your sense of humor, but the new stuff is just lame in just the perfect right way. Obviously, it's a very personal thing, but it's very much to my taste.
You're back on board.
Yeah. Oh, dear Lord.
And that kind of leads... And it's low upkeep. Like, when you play all these other campaign-type games and all these other Dungeon Delveries, you have all of these cards, all of these things to keep track of your character, all these different things. In this, all you have is your dice tray and your mat, and you don't have to go off on, you know, all these different tangents and look all these other things up. Everything is right in front of you, so huge low upkeep to keep the game going. That part I really like.
I agree with you that setup is fine. It's you have to separate chips out into different categories and then shuffle them together and things, but that's okay. Keeping track of your character and all their stats is great because it's all on this neoprene mat with these lovely little square holes that hold the dice just snugly enough, but not too snugly. Proceeding along the campaign deck is just, as you say, going down a stack of cards and reading what they are, so that's great. The one thing, though, that I do find somewhat tiresome, and this relates to the issue of length that you talked about, is that you spend a lot of time manipulating chips, just setting them up on the mat. And sometimes setting up the fight takes longer than the fight itself. And sometimes in a given game, you're going to be fighting 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times in a row. And it's just a question of, okay, setting up this guy and then setting up this guy. Oh, this guy died. Okay, I get to set up a new monster. And individually, it's trivial. Individually, it's you just take the monster, you put the identifying chip under it, you get the chips for hit points, you figure out where it needs to start, you set the die for initiative, right? I'm not going to complain about that, but when you have to, you might have to do that 6 times for a given fight, and you might be having fight after fight after fight after fight. That part of the upkeep I do find a little bit tiresome.
Yeah, and then there's sort of the math equation, right, where you have to set up the bad EQ and it has the total and you have to manipulate it slightly. But I think they realized it was a problem as well, but it was a concession they had to make it sort of generic for all of the scenarios, right? It's like, this is, no matter what enemies, whatever enemy set you use, here is the number equation we're going to use, and that way it'll flow through the whole game type thing, and we're not saying, okay, now grab these guys and put them on the map, and then therefore, every time you do this scenario, you have to fight the same guys over and over again. So I think it's just a complication they decided that they had to go with.
I agree, and it's one worth making, especially since it handles player scaling reasonably well. It's not perfect, but it's reasonably smooth, and so although I find it very, by the end of the game I do find it tiresome. By the end of the game I wish I didn't have to manipulate chips anymore, honestly. And this is not because they're chips. If they were tokens, it would be just as tedious. And I'm going to have to disagree with you a little bit about something you said earlier about the game length. You don't have that much control over the game length after all, because this is a consequence to a certain extent of the strength of the game in terms of the variety of the encounters it has. Some of the encounters you have are not combat encounters. Some of them involve choices, and some of them are very cute, but not all of them are combat encounters. So you have all the range from a short game with a boss that doesn't take much time to encounter, because that's basically the clock of the game. You try to go find the boss and kill it. And that, maybe half the cards you pull aren't combat encounters, so that game will be very, very quick, especially if you're playing solo. I've played solo games of Too Many Bones that last about a half hour, and honestly, those are great. That, you know, flies by. All the way to, once you start adding more players, that increases the length considerably and increases the number of chips you've got to manipulate and the number of times you've got to set up and the amount of setup to be done. And if you play a longer boss, and if all of them are combat encounters, we're talking about 3 to 4 hours easily. The length on the box says 90 to 120 minutes, and that I find inaccurate in both directions. I mean, a solo game is not going to last you 90 minutes, even the longer ones, very often. Sometimes it might happen. And, you know, a 3 or 4 player game, you're not getting that done in 2 hours. No way. Not a chance.
And then there's all the side scenarios that you might have to encounter. That's what I was sort of leaning towards, was the fact that they give you these options to branch off on these side scenarios that have these interesting stories, and then you can just choose to ignore those and beeline it right to the boss.
Absolutely. Just in the same way that you don't have to go fight the boss as soon as you're able. You can decide to keep pressing your luck and leveling up to try to do that if you want.
I do want to talk about leveling up.
Sure.
Because that is a huge part of the game, is deciding where to spend these training points.
Absolutely.
They've done, it's like other games that we enjoy where they make every choice as important as every other choice. You know what I mean? You don't know where to put your training points. They have this dex system where it's sort of like how many actions you're going to be able to do. It costs dex to move. And then after you're done moving, whatever dex you have left, that's how many dice you're going to roll. And then you decide if you're going to use some of your cool skill dice that you've picked out, or just generic attack dice or defense dice so you can defend yourself when you're attacked. And then, like I said, so when you get the skill points, or the training points, I should say, you have to decide, are you going to raise your dex, or are you going to raise your attack dice that you're allowed to roll, or are you going to get some of these new skills? And almost every part of these things is more important than the others, you know what I mean? So it's very hard to decide, you know, what to pick. And when you have that kind of, you know, difficulty, that's the best part about games, I think.
It's very fun. It's very cool. It's the heart of the asymmetry, but I have a couple of quibbles. One of them is, it seems most of the time, boosting your attack to astronomical levels seems stronger than a lot of the other cool skills, which is problematic primarily because the cool skills are what make you unique. The cool skills are neat. That's where the custom dice are. And it feels boring to plow a training point into just raising a numerical stat by 1 point instead of unlocking your bone saw or the new song that your bard can sing or making your wolf more badass or something like that. And I do dislike it when a game puts the cool thing at odds with the smart thing, but I'm willing to do it in the case of Too Many Bones just because, you know, it is awfully cool. So I'm not a huge fan of that. It does seem to be sort of the dominant strategy to just boost your attack stat to ungodly levels, especially
true.
If you're melee.
But you could throw it into that choice of path, right? That could be one time that you're just going to go to a super high attack path, and then that worked. So next time, you try something different.
That's true, and that leads to my second point, actually. Of the people I've played Too Many Bones with, I think, about half a dozen different people. And generally speaking, when people play the same character twice, they level them up the same way. And I'm not sure if this is a fault of the game or a fault of the players. You're pretty much the only player I've seen, and this is only the last time you played. So you and I have played about half a dozen times together, and most of the time you're the one who pursues the attacks, boosting the attack stat. You're one of the people who, after the first time you did it, opened my eyes to the fact that this was really a strong way to go. And you're one of the only people I've noticed who kind of mixes it up if you're trying the same character over again. I don't do it, but then again, I'm boring and I lack imagination. And so I wonder if that is just because players get stuck in their ways, or if it really is the case that when presented with a set of options, one does seem to be quote-unquote most obvious. The most glaring example of this, honestly, is Pickett. Pickett is probably my favorite character just because he suits my style of play, which is to say straightforward and boring. And every person who's played Pickett has always leveled Pickett up the exact same way and done very well with him. And so I wonder sometimes if the perceived variety of character builds is just an illusion, and in point of fact, there's really only one or two ways to do it, quote-unquote, optimally.
That could be. I have not played it enough, that's for sure, but I can see us playing it a lot more in the future, but I guess that's the thing we'll have to look at. So let's go with the production value.
Let's.
So, you know, when you have sleeves on all your cards, and your deck gets
I don't know that.
I know, but some of our listeners might know this problem. When you have a sleeve deck and it gets too high and you try to grab it and it shoots across the table.
That sounds like a terrible problem. Well, I don't think anyone should do that.
Multiply that by 100 when you have these PVC cards. They're like these super slippery plastic cards that if you just touch them, they slide across the table. And when you grab them, you have to use two hands because you're going to risk firing them across and hurting someone. But other than that, I sort of like them. Like you said, there's nothing you can do to hurt them. You can totally play underwater. The game will last forever. And I'm willing to overlook, you know, these small problems with... Although the clarity on some of the cards does get diminished due to this method they've used.
Yeah, so let's talk about the components. And I feel somewhat churlish issuing these complaints because, again, as a company, they stand behind their product 110%. They've been tremendously supportive when new editions have coming out, of shipping out large quantities of things at cost or below cost to make sure that everyone is as happy as possible with their purchase. But the chips are unnecessary. They could have easily been replaced with tokens. And indeed, a game that is in some ways very similar, Assault on Doomrock, gets by just fine using only tokens. And there's no fancy plastic or clay chip stuff involved, and I find it almost as tactilely satisfying to move around a stack of tokens as I do a stack of chips. I don't know, maybe there's some haptic feedback about sliding chips around neoprene that I'm missing. It's kind of neat, but I don't think they needed to go to that bother. The other thing about the cards is the cards are actually less functional because they are PVC. They've had serious printing problems where some of the text was borderline illegible. They've had to send out replacement decks of cards over and over again because of that. And yeah, they're harder to handle. They slip. The first day that I picked up the game and I tried to take the deck out the box when I was just inventorying it briefly next to my car, the entire deck flew out and I was picking Too Many Bones cards out of my car seat for weeks afterwards. It's ridiculous, and I have to assume that what happened was, and this may be unfair, and if this is false, please correct me, I have to assume that what happened was they've decided at Chip Theory Games that everything has to be deluxe, and for them, deluxe is the most expensive available option. And So the actual consequence of this is that the consumer ends up paying a lot of money for all this stuff. If they'd replaced the cards with normal cards, if they'd replaced the chips with tokens, I don't know that there would have been substantial cost savings to the consumer, but there would have been cost savings to the consumer. And we would have had functional gains as a result of this. It reminds me of that scene from Misery where, and I don't mean to compare Kathy Bates to the people at Chip Theory Games again, but Kathy Bates comes home with the most expensive paper imaginable, because she assumes that has to be the best. And then the author explains to her, well, look, this isn't for typewriters. I can't use this paper in a typewriter because it smudges. It's designed for something else. She's like, but it's the most expensive, so it has to be the best. And I encounter this attitude all the time. And I really do think that something like that has taken hold of Chip Theory Games. I wish that they were normal cards. I kind of wish that it was more affordable so that they replaced the chips with tokens. The dice, whatever. There needs to be a lot of dice in this game, and I don't fault them for that. So by all means, go crazy with that. But I do think that their attitude towards components is a little weird sometimes. So I really enjoy Too Many Bones. Sometimes I wish it were a little bit shorter. Sometimes I wish the upkeep were a little bit less. But there are genuine moments of surprise, some moments of humor, and tooling around with the different characters is genuinely fun. So if you do like co-op tactical fantasy combat games, and you're able to try someone else's copy because it's a very expensive game, then I'd say give it a shot. Undertow is a marvelous product. I really do think that the way that they've been opening up their encounter card variety, and I think their writing has been getting better, and the variety of stuff, even in the smaller standalone expansion, Too Many Bones Undertow is great. The only downside, though, and the only reason why I can't recommend Too Many Bones Undertow unequivocally, is that it only comes with two characters. And some of the real joy in the game is tooling around with the characters. So at the end of the day, there's not really a great entry point for the series. The base game is really expensive, and Undertow is better in a lot of other ways, but only has two characters. So buyer beware, and be careful about how you spend your money. But I really do think that Chip Theory Games is onto something with this. I haven't liked the other games at all, really. I thought that Hoplomachus was, an excuse to pull out neoprene and chips, but Too Many Bones has been consistently entertaining, even though sometimes I wish it were a little bit less upkeep and a little bit less shuffling things around.
And I think it's doing well, so I'm very interested to see where they go after this, because I'm sure that, they, much like other companies do, they streamline it, they change it, they do a different, slide it over to a wholly different genre, a different theme. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes from them next.
And that is Too Many Bones, specifically Too Many Bones Undertow. So our topic this week is difficulty in co-ops. How hard should co-ops be? Walker, I think a good starting point for this discussion is for you to repeat to us again, I think you've mentioned it before on the podcast, what it is you say about your desired win rate in co-ops.
10%.
Why is that?
Because I just think it should be hard. I think it leads to replay, at least for me, replayability. Like, if I win all the time, I'm really not that eager to play the game. If all I'm going to do is take it all out, set it all up, and look, I've won again. what I mean? And that last moment, that pulling it out of the brink at the very end, that last turn, struggling, trying different methods, like saying, okay, let's try, that didn't work. Let's quickly set it up and let's try this, totally different, scrap everything we tried last time and, hit it from a whole totally different direction. I think that's what makes these really tough co-ops fun. I want to do a generic co-op thing, and that's the fact that the only weapon, that's what I say to everyone when we talk about co-ops, the only weapon co-ops have is randomness, all right? That they're going to pull off these random cards because no one's running the other side, so it's going to be these random decks, these random dice, random things are going to happen, and sometimes you get hit really hard by randomness, but we're going to talk about games that do it properly. And there's another type of co-op, which is the one and done, like we've seen it in exit games, in Unlock, and that's why...
You're still not saying it right.
Unlock!
Thank you.
They work because the randomness is taken out, because, you don't need to go back again. You do it one time and it's over with, and that's why they work that much better, because you don't need the randomness anymore, because you only get to play it once. So like you said, let's talk about games that do it properly. Why? How do they, make this randomness not so bad? What do I have here? Mixing rewards and trials in the same deck. Now, we've encountered this with Who Goes There, where they have things that will help you and things that will hurt you in the same deck. Zombicide does this as well, and Pathfinder, the card game, does this as well. Whereas games that do it better have different decks where, you know, this is when something bad's, you just draw from this deck. It's all bad things, so you're not going to get messed up. And you did well, so here's your reward deck. You draw from that. It's going to be something randomly that you get that's always good.
Yeah, the only time I think when mixing the rewards and the penalties together in the same deck is when it's just a part of the game clock, and the example that comes to mind is Pandemic. I don't mind that the epidemics are mixed in with the player deck because it's just a thing you do at the end of your turn. I really didn't like having to go to search through a deck in Who Goes There or games of that ilk, because you really do have to. That's how the game advances. And it could be anything from, here's this amazing thing, to, oh, I'm going to punch you in the face. That was not the kind of variance that I thought was particularly good, and I also don't think that it leads to a consistent difficulty curve. It just, it was too variable in a way that was unsatisfying to me.
The next thing I have here is power ramp up. And that means, like, as you progress in the game, it gets more and more difficult, and how other games do it. So there's games like, why didn't I put that game in there? The game that I hate, Eldritch Horror, which doesn't even have this. It just, you know, you're always drawing monsters from the same queue, and there's no ramp up. It's just your characters get more powerful, and the first turn you might draw this crazy demon that there's no way you can beat, and near the end of the game, when you're so powerful, you're going to draw, you know, the little skittering thing that you're wasting your whole turn trying to deal with. So the power ramp up options to do a lower level, games like Kingdom Death Monster, when you go out on a mission, you get to sort of scale it the way you think your party can handle it, right? It's not an automatic ramp up, right? So you can sort of do it. And Spirit Island is the same. You get to set the difficulty at the beginning of the game. And there's all sorts of other games like that. I couldn't come up with any. Maybe you'll come up with some that you get to. Mage Knight sort of does it as you reveal more of the map. You don't have to go out to those areas. You can, you know, clear up the end bits because you know you're not powerful enough yet. The other characters have got, you know, better breaks. So games that give you options to do lower level stuff like that.
So I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I've been thinking it in the context as well of games that want to provide a narrative. Because just in the same way that you've been thinking more and more that for you a good game provides good flow, I've been thinking that for me a good game provides a good arc. That things build to an appropriate tempo, that you're not doing the same thing over and over and over again, that there's at least fluidity, if not actually a solid beginning, middle, and an end. I talked about them in the context of El Grande. And I think that to a certain extent, one of the reasons why I find a co-op loss unsatisfying is the same reason why I find a lot of narratives in games unsatisfying. And that is that good narratives for me are often about failure. Some of the stories that I really like often involve salient elements of people failing. But in board games, failure is very difficult to render interestingly. Usually it's rendered as something not achieving an effect, just not working. So as a result, you either spend resources or your time or an action or what have you doing nothing, which is not fun. And it doesn't lead to that kind of interesting narrative. I'm talking specific. Video games work the same way, too. A lot of my favorite video games have been stories about failure, which kind of undercuts the whole sort of, God complex wish fulfillment that a lot of video games are about. I'm thinking about games like, not that we want to talk too much about video games, but, you know, Dragon Age 2 or Spec Ops The Line, or things like even The Walking Dead Season 1. You know, games about where the main characters just fail. And, you know, no spoilers. But, and so co-op games, when you lose, they don't really provide a conclusion. They just end. But then again, they often don't really provide a conclusion. They just end when you succeed as well. And Too Many Bones, for all its strengths, sometimes its ends are very anticlimactic too, because the goal of the game is to kill the boss. And sometimes killing the boss is either trivial or just as a result of an opportunistic fluke or something like that. And those aren't often very satisfying ends. And when you lose Too Many Bones, it's because you just run out of time, which, again, not particularly satisfying. So the best that I think you can do, and I've been thinking about this, in order to build to a crescendo of to give you some sort of sense of an arc, is the way that Street Masters does it, the way that Gloomhaven does it, the way that Spirit Island does it. You ramp up in power so that the threats that you were facing at the beginning, you were barely holding on, or indeed sometimes they were just wiping the floor with you. But you eventually get strong enough, and you grapple with the resources that you have available, or you ramp up in power, so that you are encouraged to be able to blow everything out near the end of the game in an orgiastic frenzy of, in those cases, destruction, because all those games are about destruction. Gloomhaven does this with the way that you can lose a card permanently by triggering a stronger effect. Street Masters does this because you can pull off things called feints, and you have to build up your tactics to get there. Spirit Island does this because you just become incredibly powerful near the end of the game, and you feel like the sort of primeval nature spirit that you represent. And those, I think, are the closest proxy for how you can get a good arc out of a co-op game rather than just a never-ending stream of nonsense. So, but let me bring this back to difficulty then, and I want to talk a little bit about Spirit Island, because Spirit Island, most of the time, is way too easy. At level zero difficulty, or even level, you know, two or three, especially if anyone at the table knows what they're doing, in my experience, it's very, very, very difficult to lose. In fairness, I've read some comments from people talking about how Spirit Island, even at the base level difficulty, is way too hard. They don't see how they can win. I don't know what they're doing. I'm not saying that I'm so much better a Spirit Island player than you are. Indeed, the designer, Eric Royce, commented that he wanted around a 90% win rate for difficulty level zero. I don't know why. It's not a strength of the game. The only reason why it works in the context of a game like Spirit Island is because the levers are so intricate that you can forget the fact that you're basically in a cakewalk. Also because of this thing that I talked about, the arc. Because at the beginning of the game, the invaders move so quickly that if you haven't played before, or even if you played once or twice, you can't even begin to imagine how you could keep up, much less overtake them. But then by the end of the game, you're crushing them, absolutely massacring them. And it's just an incredible red tide that they can't stand in the way of. Which is to say, all this is to say, that most of the games that I appreciate in terms of co-op tend to be too easy, but hide it well. Because again, I have yet to encounter a co-op where failure was really interesting and led you to an interesting result other than just, you're done now because you didn't do what you needed to do and you've run out of time. If anyone out there listening can think of a co-op with a really, really good end game when you lose, by all means, please point it out to me, because that is something I would really like to experience.
That fits into this, the other category I have written here. It's too long to lose versus too short to care.
Yeah.
Right? Where a game is so long that maybe the designers, you know, don't, you know, I mean, it would be such a disappointment to, after a 3-hour game, to, you know, like, lose to something foolish. And then you have games like The Grizzled, which they're so short, it doesn't matter. You just, okay, well, we lost that one, start again, go again. You know, you just go over and over again. So, like, you can make it infinitely hard because it's so quick that you can do, you know, you can do about 6 games and try to get through one of them.
So most of the co-ops that I know you like fall well short of the 10%, they fall well short of the 90% loss rate that you say that you want. Level 7 Invasion, you seem to agree with me that it was probably too easy. Sentinels of the Multiverse does have some harder scenarios, but I don't think that the particularly hard ones are especially fun. They tend to just constrain you and get rid of all your toys, and that's not particularly enjoyable. We've commented before that Sentinels can just be wacky sometimes. So what are some really hard co-op games that you think do difficulty well?
Robinson Crusoe, I really think they do really hard difficulty well. Ghost Stories.
Yes.
Very difficult game. I think they do it well.
That's on my list too. Ghost Stories, I think, is a great example of a really hard game where you can get better. And not in a way, not even in a way it's like, oh, I've seen the deck, I know what's in the deck. Because that's a level of improvement that's fine. But it's much better to be like, okay, I now understand how to tactically take advantage of the situation better now. I have a genuine experience about how to be a better player. And so I think Ghost Stories is a great example of a really hard game that you can get better at.
Yeah, that's the other title I have here, is Finding the Right Combo. And that is sort of prevalent in Sentinels as well, where you, when you ramp it up to a harder boss like Dark Legacy or you go into advanced mode, it's finding the right combination of characters to take on that boss, or the right equipment, depending on what game you're playing, you know, bringing the right equipment, bringing the right characters in, doing the right thing, finding the different combos in order to overcome why you're losing all the time.
Yeah, but sometimes that can be done well and sometimes that can be done badly.
Well, for sure.
In the case of Ghost Stories, making your different Taoists synergize properly is a really interesting tactical puzzle, and that's one of the skills that you need to bring to bear, and that kind of combo is great. The kind of combos that sometimes you discover in Sentinels of the Multiverse are desperately unsatisfying, like the exploit that I talked about where Tempest, like, okay, yeah, Knock Tempest out right away, become immune to a type of damage, that's it, we're done, we win. That it's not as satisfying. It feels
true,
like just
but not all the Sentinels combos are like that. That
it's
is
true.
Definitely one
You're
that's
right.
bad, but there are some that are good, too.
You're right. The other games that I have here that are really hard, but you can get genuinely better at them, are Hanabi. Hanabi, I think, is a wonderful co-op game where it is a genuine skill, most of the people I've seen who comment that Hanabi is too easy and they win all the time, and by win I mean get to 25 points, because Hanabi, you don't really, there are ways you can lose, which doesn't happen very often, but usually it's just a question of making your score better up to 25. The overwhelming majority of the time when someone talks about how easy Hanabi is and you start interrogating them, it's clear that they're cheating rampantly. They just ignore all the communication restrictions, or they've sat together and they've developed their own communication shorthand, which I consider cheating at Hanabi. But Hanabi, there's a genuine skill at getting better and getting better heuristics and finding out how to make better inferences and better clues. Assault on Doomrock is the same way. I've yet to win a game of Assault on Doomrock legit. I've played over a dozen times, but I've never won. So we're talking about less than a 10% win rate. I could just be really bad at Assault on Doomrock, but most other people talk about how hard it is too. But nonetheless, I feel like I'm getting better. I feel like I know a little bit more every time I play and lose, and maybe someday I'll win, and that'll be a very exciting moment. But so I agree with you. If a co-op game is good enough such that A, the systems allow you to get better in a way that feels satisfying rather than encouraging you to find exploits, and B, is really, really challenging, that is often the sweet spot. I just often find that sometimes the systems are challenging just because it's a random deluge or anything like that.
Oh, I often find too that because I think, I'm not sure if it's computer games, that's this another analogy I come up with when I play with people that get very frustrated when they're losing. And I'm wondering if it's because people are playing a lot of video games where when you don't succeed, boom, you reset, you go again. You know what I mean? So, and the expectation to succeed every time is there. So when they play these games, their expectation is to succeed, or there's always a way to win. And it's like, no, we've made these mistakes. You know, there's nothing we can do. We're done. And so I'm wondering if that's some of the things that are the problem.
Right, yeah, I agree. That's why some of my favorite video games have been narratives about failure, or the kind of game where you're not expected to succeed, like your roguelikes, like your competitive fighting games, like your incredibly difficult shmups. Those are games where you're expected to get your rear end handed to you over and over and over again, but then eventually claw some sort of skill back. And I don't really find, and let me be clear, I think you and I are a little bit different in that I'm not looking for a particular level of difficulty. I'm just looking for the difficulty to be managed in a certain way. If the win rate is close to 100%, but I nonetheless feel like I'm making progress and getting a better sense of how the game works, and I feel that the game systems are deep enough that they reward further exploration, I'm kind of okay with that. I'm not a huge fan of games that are too easy, but by the same token, I'm not a fan of the way lots of co-ops manage difficulty. Like, they just start upping numbers, for example, or they just start throwing in more bad stuff at a higher rate. I'm more interested in the slightly nuanced ways that you can manage difficulty. And again, I think Spirit Island does a great job of that. The way that Spirit Island increases difficulty and changes things up with the different adversaries and scenarios, I think, is really, really a good way to do it. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why playing with experienced Spirit Island players is so great, because everyone at the table knows how easy the game is on base difficulty, and you typically have no problem convincing them that you need to ramp things up as high as they could possibly go.
So when I was thinking about this, I've come up with this theory. I want to know what you think. This is I have here the ultimate co-op game. I want to know what you think.
Okay.
D&D is the ultimate co-op game, because really you can say it's one versus many, but the DM is not trying to win. He or she, whoever is the game master, is trying to keep the level playing field. And I think that is a very hard skill to do. And I think he's part of their team and trying to keep them interested and move the adventure along and keep everyone involved. So I think it's like this synergy between all of the players. So it's a cooperative game. And I think they've done a fantastic job of making it that way and keeping it even. What do you think?
I think, given the mindset of most role players, I'd have to disagree with you, because D&D, and this is one of the reasons why I don't really play D&D anymore or similar campaign-based role-playing games, because you get so invested in your character. Again, to me, satisfying stories are often, not always, this is not the only kind of satisfying story, but the satisfying story is often about failure, and is often about, it includes things like self-sacrifice, includes things like, in the case of heroic fantasy, certainly about things like heroic last stands. But you get so attached to your character and you've spent so much time with them, you're often not willing to let the interests of the narrative trump your own selfish interests in the character continuing existence. And that's why I like one-shots like Durant's or Fiasco, because you get attached to your character, but the time frame is condensed and the type of story you're telling is such that you know that the character has a strong chance of not making it out alive. And so you just get opened up in terms of the story. So that's an instance of where D&D, I think, the story elements are fighting against the game elements. I do agree with you, however, that somebody who a very practiced game master is able to calibrate difficulty just perfectly. And if they're able to get everyone on the knife edge and make every victory feel earned, and like every defeat could have been reversed if they had known something better going in, then that would be good. But the problem there again is that, you know, defeats in D&D are often driven by, you know, just insurmountable number barriers, as opposed to, you know, a clever absence of tactics. Anyhow, so in this topic, we've talked about board games and video games and role-playing games. Next, we can talk about snooker. How's that? I guess sports is the next thing. How do you feel about difficulty in sports?
How about this, the hidden traitor in these co-op games? How does that pull a... Because there's Shadows over Camelot, The Thing, Dead of Winter, these games that now suddenly Battlestar Galactica...
So you mentioned all the bad ones.
Is there a good one?
The Resistance.
Oh, the Resistance. Yeah.
That's a
social deduction game. I suppose you could call these other ones.
Yeah. I actually think, insofar as you want to label the Resistance a co-op, which I guess you kind of could, in that the majority of the players are playing a co-op effectively, then that's an example of a really good, really hard co-op. Because in the Resistance, most of the time, all things being equal, the spies are going to win. And that makes the Resistance wins all the more satisfying. And indeed, when I win a game of the Resistance as a member of the Resistance, it really does feel earned. It feels like a memorable experience. And that is, I think, an example, if you want to shoehorn it rather uncomfortably into the co-op sphere, which I don't think it belongs there. But that kind of sensation, though, nonetheless, is what I get out of a really well-calibrated co-op.
Gotcha.
So you don't want to talk about sports. Okay, good. So that's going to close us out for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you so very much for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach Walker via his email, justrolledadice@gmail.com. You can reach me, Mark Bigney, on Twitter, @thegamesyoulike, assuming that this plague has not ended my life. For more public discussion, you can find the So Very Wrong About Games Facebook page, or you can check out our Board Game Geek Guild, which is guild number 3236. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if you can. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon. Take care, and until next week.
If you like this show, tell a friend.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter @sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.